This is Science Friday from NPR News. I'm Ira Flatow. A bit later in the hour, we'll be talking with a neuroscientist and Nobel Prize winner Eric Kandel about a new movie. But first, have you ever heard of fracking? Fracking, it's short for hydraulic fracturing, and it's a process that blasts water, sand, and chemicals into underground rock deposits to release natural gas. And fracking has mostly been used in the western United States, but new discoveries of gas-rich rock in a formation called the Marcellus Shale, which stretches from New York down through Pennsylvania into West Virginia, could mean a lot more fracking in a lot more places, and it has created quite a controversy. Some people are worried about what fracking can do to groundwater or what to do with the wastewater that it is produced. Does it find its way? Are there spills on the drilling sites into streams and places like that? What does it do to the wildlife in those areas? That's what we'll be talking about this hour, the progress and the politics of the process. And my guests are Gwen Latdahl. She is the director and founder of the Earthworks Oil and Gas Accountability Project, and she joins us from Durango, Colorado. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you, Ira. It's a pleasure to be on the show.
Thank you. Kathleen Scama is the director of government affairs for the Independent Petroleum Association of Mountain States in Denver. And thank you for being with us today, Kathleen.
Thank you for having me, Ira.
Tell us how fracking is done.
Well, we drill a well for natural gas or oil, and we drill down several thousand feet into a source rock layer containing natural gas or oil, and we may drill horizontally through that rock layer. And because of the intense pressure and because of the depth that we're drilling at, it's not easy for the natural gas to flow from that source rock into the wellbore. So we do a process called hydraulic fracture stimulation, whereby we pump water and sand and some chemicals, a mixture of those, down in through the wellbore and into down below ground into the source rock, and literally try to crack that open. And, you know, we're lucky if we can get some horizontal cracks about, a few hundred feet out, if we're lucky, because of the intense pressure. But it's important to note that before we do that fracturing process, we've cemented and cased that wellbore. So there's a steel pipe that runs the length of that well. There's cement around that to ensure that nothing can go from the wellbore to any adjacent layers or into an aquifer. So it's a very safe process. It's been used in over 60 years in over a million wells across the United States.
So what happens when something does go wrong and you have these spills of thousands of gallons of the drilling fluid out onto the surface?
Well, there are regulations in place. States heavily regulate every process involved with fracturing or with drilling a well. So if there is an accident, there are measures in place to make sure that's cleaned up and to handle that. You know, we work very hard to ensure the environmental impact is very minimal.
Because we've had reports of various states of up to 8,000 gallons spilled out into the area. There have been reports of fish dying in creeks and places where the water and the chemicals have impacted the environment.
Right. There was a case, Dunkards Creek in Pennsylvania, that was blamed on natural gas, and it turns out it was a coal mine discharge. So there are lots of anecdotes out there.
It's not what I read in the other sources. They don't agree with you, obviously.
Well, don't take my word for it then. The EPA under the Clinton, Bush, and now the Obama administration has repeated that there have been no cases of contamination of drinking water from hydraulic fracturing, and state regulators in all the states that have oil and gas development have also made that point.
Well, I'm not talking about the drinking water. I'm talking about the creeks and the spillage that comes out of the site.
Again, as I was saying, there are regulations in place to handle that. If an unfortunate accident does occur, the company's responsible for cleaning that up. Mm-hmm. And that was the case recently in Pennsylvania, where there was a spill, and it was handled accordingly.
Kathleen, what problem do you have with all of this?
Well, I don't have a problem with it. You know, we've been developing natural gas and oil in this country for over 150 years.
Yeah, so you're
the last 60 of which we've been using hydraulic fracturing with an exemplary safety record.
Gwen Lackalt, you are concerned that we really don't know what's in some of these chemicals being pumped in there.
Well, that's correct. And, you know, I'm a community organizer by training with a degree in political science. And I can tell you that fracturing is a big political issue. And we don't really have the science. And it's turned into a game of he said, she said. And we really do need the science. We need the EPA to conduct a comprehensive study of the practice. And we need to require companies to disclose the chemical constituents that they use in drilling and fracturing fluids.
Well, you mean we don't know what's in those chemicals? What the chemicals are?
That's correct. And industry has for years stood behind what they call trade secrets, and that they don't want to disclose their recipe, if you will, for fracturing fluids. Mm-hmm. And our position is, you know, that's fine. Coca-Cola, the Coca-Cola recipe is secret, but we know what the ingredients are. Those ingredients are listed on the side of the can, and we believe the same needs to be true for communities that face oil and gas development.
What kind of ingredients do we know of? Do we know about some of them?
Well, some of the chemicals are disclosed on material safety data sheets that we've been able to get from our local fire stations, and those list everything from trade names like Zetaflow and all sorts of propants and gels, and that benzene, toluene, ethylene glycol, that those are some of the things that are contained in fracturing fluids.
When you have a hazardous material spill, don't the fire department, don't they like to know what they're going to be cleaning up when they come and clean it up?
Exactly. They need to know what they're dealing with. So a lot of those chemicals have to be disclosed on these MSDS, mm-hmm. material safety data sheets, but those lists aren't complete. And we need to have full disclosure of the chemicals used in these operations so emergency responders know what they're going to be dealing with once they arrive at a site where there may be an incident.
Kathleen, what would be wrong with that, with the disclosure of all the chemicals?
Absolutely nothing, because that's the current case today. On a well site, you have all the material safety data sheets for every chemical that's contained on that site. We comply with all regulations as far as that goes. If you would like a list, everything is disclosed. Pennsylvania and New York State's environmental departments both have comprehensive list of chemicals. The Groundwater mm-hmm. Protection Council, which is a body of state regulators, also publishes a list of the chemicals used, and certainly in the event of an accident, those material data safety data sheets are handed to responders and are on site exactly for that reason. And the specifics are available to regulators who are responsible for ensuring it's environmentally sound.
Gwen, what's wrong with that?
Well, that's exactly why we need to pass a bill that's before Congress today. It's called the FRAC Act, the Fracturing Responsibility and Awareness of Chemicals Act. And that bill would set a federal floor, and it would require that fracturing be regulated and that chemicals be disclosed. And currently, we do not have every state in the country does not regulate the practice of hydraulic fracturing, and we have 32 oil and gas producing states. So this bill would set a federal floor. States are welcome to pass mm-hmm. additional regulations governing fracturing.
Mm-hmm. And Kathleen, you say that despite Pennsylvania citing the Cabot Oil and Gas Company last February, I'm reading from a Forbes article, for contaminating wells used for drinking near drill sites, you're going to stick with your line that none of this gets contaminated.
Right. There's been no case of contamination of drinking water from fracturing in its 60-year history. And as for disclosure and regulation, all the states who have oil and gas already regulate the process very heavily. If they want to add more laws for disclosure, as New York is set to do, they can certainly do that. But, it's regulated heavily today.
Mm-hmm. Gwen, any final words?
Well, our position is that hydraulic fracturing is an unregulated practice. And in 2005, due to heavy industry lobbying, the Congress exempted the practice of hydraulic fracturing from the Safe Drinking Water Act. And companies are not required to disclose the chemical constituents, with the exception of a new requirement in Colorado. So no one is actually monitoring for contamination. And until we have full public disclosure, we won't know what chemicals to test for when there is an incident. So because this practice is unregulated and we don't know what chemicals to test for, we haven't seen what the issues really are or potentially could be from this practice.
That's just not true. We are subject to the Safe Drinking Water Act. We have been since 1974 when the act was put in place. The only thing that we are not is Safe Drinking Water Act does not require fracking specifically to be under a particular underground injection control permit program. But as far as handling the materials at the top of the at the surface and the wastewater, that's all handled in accordance with the Safe Drinking
Water Act. But there's no regulations for underground.
Absolutely.
You're saying that just for the stuff that's above the ground. There's no EPA regulations.
There is not, because the states are regulating it that now, and the EPA under the last three administrations has said that they don't need to regulate it and that it is a safe practice.
That might change with this bill coming up. Who knows? We'll see. Thank you both for taking time to be with us. Gwen Leckholt is the director and founder of the Earthworks Oil and Gas Accountability Project. She was in Durango, Colorado. And Kathleen Scama is the director of government affairs for the Independent Petroleum Association of Mountain States. She was in Denver. Thank you all, and have a good weekend to you.
You too.
We're going to take a short break and come back and talk lots more with one of my favorite guys. Dr. Eric Kandel is here. He's going to talk about, he just turned 80. Happy birthday. And also is a new film out. He stars in his own documentary film, which is an interesting take. Maybe he's going into the movie business. We'll talk about him. You know, he's won the Nobel Prize. And so there's a lot to talk about. 1-800-989-8255. Vera Kandel up after the break. Stay with us. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from NPR News. This is Science Friday from NPR News. I'm Ira Flatow. Last year at this time, the Hubble Space Telescope was in serious need of a little bit of TLC. It had a couple of dead cameras, a broken spectrograph, aging batteries, a flaky gyroscope, and on top of all that, a major piece of hardware blew out, and a scheduled repair mission was put off for months, leaving us to wonder if Hubble might be left there twisting in the solar wind, so to speak. But the final repair mission went off without a hitch last May, updating the old parts, outfitting Hubble with a sharp new camera, the Wide Field Camera 3. And astronomers have already discovered amazing star stuff with that new camera, detecting what could be the most distant galaxies known to science, formed not too long after the birth of the universe. That's just one of the bits of news coming out of the American Astronomical Society meeting in Washington, D.C. And my guest has been hanging out there this week. Ron Cowan is the astronomy writer for Science News in Washington. He joins us from our studios at NPR. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks a lot, Ari. Hi.
And if you want to know more about Ron's work, you can read it at sciencenews.org. Sounds like interesting stuff coming out of there. What is this old galaxy?
Well, there's it's three of the oldest galaxies in the universe, they think. The finding is tentative, but these are galaxies that they believe lie 13.2 billion light years from Earth, and we're seeing them very close to what's called cosmic dawn, the era when the first galaxies and stars turned on, just a few hundred million years after the Big Bang. That few hundred million years may sound like a long time, but that's actually pretty darn close to the birth of the universe. Mm-hmm. It's just very, very exciting they can do this with the Hubble.
Wow. There were another set of discoveries, this time exoplanets from Kepler. Tell us what Kepler was and what this discovery.
Yes. The Kepler telescope, it was launched into space last March, and its main mission is to look for planets beyond the solar system that are in the so-called habitable zone that could support life, and in fact, Earth-like planets. But what's exciting here is that just after its first 6 weeks of data, Kepler has already found five alien planets, extrasolar planets. None of them yet are Earth-like. One is a Neptune, a body similar in mass to Neptune, the other four similar in mass to Jupiter. They're very close to their parent stars. They're hot enough that the temperature would be enough to melt lava on their surface. Yeah. They're not habitable, but it's very exciting that in just 6 weeks, Kepler did this. It bodes well for finding Earth-like planets during the next 3.5 years of its mission.
And how does it work? How does this probe work?
Right. Well, what it does is it looks for planets that pass across the face of their parent star. And each time a planet does that, it creates a little mini eclipse. It eclipses like 1% or less of the starlight. And Kepler is that sensitive that it can look for this tiny little wink out of light. And, of course, it happens periodically each time the planet passes in front of its parent star. And so these are called transits. Kepler finds those. Then they contact someone on the ground with a telescope that can look for the tug back and forth, the tiny tug that the planet exerts on its parent star, and then you find the mass that way. So you can find the size of the size of the planet from Kepler, the mass from ground-based telescopes.
Interesting. Talking with Ron Cohen of Science News, writer there. You can read more about his stuff at sciencenews.org. Let's talk about you mentioned the earliest galaxies we've ever seen, but there was also something at the meeting about the earliest supernovas or supernovae.
Yes, or supernovae, right. Well, there was, now the most distant supernova we think exists, these are exploding stars. They're not as bright as so you can't see them quite as far back in time, but there's another type of explosion called a gamma ray burst. And gamma ray bursts are this incredible outpouring of gamma ray light that we think signifies the birth of a black hole. You can see those very, very far away. And the light from this gamma ray burst pierced its home galaxy, and the dust on its way that it pierced seems to be dust from a supernova. So we've deduced some of the earliest stardust, or they call it smoke, from a supernova that we've ever seen in the universe before. It's indirect, but they believe that they found it.
Is that where they think that these gamma ray bursts all come from?
Well, a gamma ray burst, in fact, comes from a particular type of supernova, but these supernovae would be just a whole string of supernovae in the galaxy that would be separate from the one the gamma ray burst was given birth to. Mm-hmm.
The new NASA administrator, Charles Bolden, spoke at the conference. Give us some take-home points.
Right. Well, he was certainly very folksy, and one of the things he said was that back in 1980, when he was training as an astronaut, he said to the audience that if someone had told him then that we would not have returned to the moon with a manned mission yet, that he would have told that those people, they would have been smoking dope. So that got a big laugh from everybody.
Was the old Arthur C. He stole Arthur C. Clarke's line, you know.
Arthur
C. Clarke said many years ago. Yeah, Arthur C. Clarke said many years ago, on I think maybe, let's say, the 25th anniversary of the moonwalk, he said, what's the most exciting, amazing thing about going to the moon? And he said that we could go there and not go back.
But I think Bolden was you know, giving some signals that, well, you know, we will go on to Mars, but it might be more gradual. We're going to, you know, we can't pay for big, expensive missions. We're going to need international cooperation. I think he was giving hints that we may not go back to the moon and Mars quite so fast, at least in my opinion. And we'll have to wait for what Obama says, I guess, in his State of the Union address. But I think Bolden was giving hints like that. But I think the audience loved him. And he, you know, he was very natural.
Yeah, he was. But was he focusing on international space missions, or did he just mention that in passing?
I think he just mentioned that in passing, but saying that, you know, for big missions in the future, we're really going to have to find other ways to pay for them, and we're going to have to go with other countries to do that.
Anything on upcoming, you know, on the Webb telescope? Any mention of that when Hubble is gone?
Yes, in the sense that the fact that these candidate distant galaxies that they think they found from so far back in time and so distant, we are not really going to be able to examine them closely and confirm for sure that they really are as distant until the James Webb Space Telescope gets launched in 2014. Hubble found these distant galaxies, or these candidate distant galaxies, with looking at them at just one infrared wavelength. And James Webb is a much bigger telescope, and it's going to look at several infrared wavelengths at these same objects and really confirm not just that they exist, but how massive are they? Do they have a black hole at their center? All kinds of things which we really are dying to know, because this is just the earliest moments of galaxy formation in the universe. And it's just, but it's also remarkable what we've done already.
Well, sounds like a good time was had by all at this meeting.
It was great. It was a lot of fun.
All right, Ron, thanks for taking time to be with us. Ron Cowan is the astronomy writer for Science News in Washington, and you can get more on the meeting by going to their website at sciencenews.org.
The University of Alabama won college football's national championship game last night. Alabama went into it ranked number one. It beat number two ranked Texas 37-21 to clinch the BCS championship. It's Alabama's first title since 1992, and it didn't come easy. NPR's Tom Goldman has more.
In this battle of two storied college football programs with two storied football slogans, it was Hook'em Horns of Texas that first resounded throughout the Rose Bowl. Texas was on the move early, passing and running well against Alabama's vaunted defense. To get a feel for the section of the Rose Bowl dressed in Texas burnt orange, I called NPR correspondent Wade Goodwin, Texas class of 82. His wife had bought him a ticket, nice wife, as a birthday present.
Even though they said they didn't think we'd be able to run on Alabama, it looks like we're going to be able to run on Alabama, at least early.
The excitement of the moment masked the concern by Wade and other Texas fans about their star quarterback, Colt McCoy. On the Longhorns' fifth offensive play of the game, McCoy left with an injured right shoulder. The hit that sent him to the sidelines didn't look that bad. Surely he'd be back. But he never returned, and as the second quarter began, Roll Tide Roll became the slogan of the night.
Ingram gets the handoff left. Into the end zone. Touchdown, Alabama!
Heisman Trophy winning running back Mark Ingram rumbled into the end zone for Alabama's first points of the game, as heard here on ESPN Radio. They were the first points of many. Alabama led 24-6 at halftime. Texas was reeling with a very green freshman quarterback, Garrett Gilbert, at the helm. Longhorns head coach, Mack Brown.
You know, here's a guy on the sideline standing there, cold as could be, and all of a sudden in the national championship game, you say, okay, son, you got it. So I can't even imagine.
Brown says he told Gilbert, you're a good player. It's a hard learning curve, and you got to learn fast. And wouldn't you know it, in the second half, Gilbert fired a 44-yard touchdown pass to Jordan Shipley. Then, in the fourth quarter, this.
Take the shot down, Gilbert. Shipley's open. Touchdown, Texas! Oh, he got wide open down the right side.
The 28-yard TD pass to Shipley and a two-point conversion made the score 24-21. Suddenly, a great game. Just as suddenly, over. Gilbert's magic ran out when he fumbled after getting blasted by an Alabama defender. A few plays later, Ingram put the game out of reach with his second touchdown run. Time expired, Alabama was crowned BCS champion, and watching in Texas, Joe Barton wondered what could have been. Not because he's a Texas fan, but because Congressman Joe Barton has led the charge for a playoff system in college football.
The way both Texas and Alabama played tonight, you'd have to say Florida would have given either one of these teams a pretty good game. I think Boise State would have. Maybe Ohio State. I mean, you know, if you decided on an open playoff system, it'd be a truer test.
The man who's in charge of the current system, BCS Executive Director Bill Hancock, said before the game, the BCS is not completely popular, but I believe in it. Today, a bunch of people wearing Alabama crimson couldn't agree more. Tom Goldman, NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Alyssa Block.
And I'm Michelle Norris. Tough news today for the millions of people struggling to find work. The latest jobs numbers are worse than expected. In December, the economy shed another 85,000 jobs. President Obama called that a matter of concern to every American.
The jobs numbers that were released by the Labor Department this morning are a reminder that the road to recovery is never straight.
NPR's Frank Langfitt explains what the numbers tell us about where we are on that road to recovery.
The U.S. economy has been out of recession for months, but you wouldn't know it from today's jobs report. Instead of showing progress, the labor market sagged again, as firms ranging from construction to retail laid off tens of thousands in December. Heidi Shierholz works for the Economic Policy Institute, a labor think tank in Washington. She says today's report shows any jobs recovery will take time.
It's going to be a long haul. We're not only not adding jobs, we're still losing jobs at a steady pace right now.
The government says the economy began growing again in the summer and early fall, but most employers are still reluctant to hire. Mark Fittner is managing director at Wells Fargo. He says companies are uncertain about the strength of consumer demand, and they don't know how major legislation, such as health care reform, will affect their bottom line.
Businesses are saying, how am I going to commit to hiring workers when I don't know how much it's going to cost me to employ them? And if they don't know what it's going to cost to hire a worker, they're not likely to move forward with that decision until they feel a lot more certain about the economic environment.
What is true is we're all disappointed. I'm sure the American people are disappointed.
That's Christina Romer. She's the White House's chief economist, and she was reacting to today's labor report. Romer says recoveries can be slow and halting. For instance, the government's revised figures for November show the economy actually grew by 4,000 jobs that month. But 4,000 jobs is too small to have much of an impact in a labor market that employs more than 138 million people.
This is how real recoveries happen. They come in fits and starts, and now looks like November was a start and December was a little bit of a fit.
Romer noted a bright spot in today's report. Temporary hiring grew in December. That's the fourth month in a row, and it's important.
As companies start to ramp up and hire again, many of them usually turn to temporary labor first to get, you know, someone in the door quickly and get the work done.
Joni Ruge works for Adecco, the temporary services giant.
We're seeing an increase in some of our manufacturing customers. The demand for products is increasing, and they're starting to add people back, even in, you know, the warehouses and production facilities. So that's a very good sign.
But those new jobs for temp workers last month were offset by continued layoffs in the construction business. Carl Case is an economics professor at Wellesley College. He says the glut of foreclosures has reduced demand for workers to build new homes.
We're not building anything. People say, why should I buy a new house if I can get an old house that's deeply discounted to get it sold?
Economists say the labor market won't begin to grow until sometime this spring. Last month, the unemployment rate held steady at 10%, but economists think it will rise. That's because any job increases are expected to be modest, not enough to soak up the millions of people who are unemployed or the new workers entering the job market. Frank Langfitt, NPR News, Washington.
Nigeria has never competed in the Winter Olympic sport called skeleton. In fact, Nigeria has never sent any athlete to any Winter Games event. One Nigerian-American wants to change that. A 26-year-old graduate of Yale Law School has decided that the headfirst sled is the way to bring his home country winter glory, hopefully in 2014. But his obstacles go far beyond sport, as NPR's Mike Pesca tells us.
Sean Adebiyi was 6 years old when he left Nigeria and arrived in Alabama. It was the only place his mother, a math professor, could get a job. She was the kind of woman for whom the challenge of being a single mom in a new country wasn't enough. She founded a nonprofit to educate school children. To fund her teaching, she and Sean picked crops, but that was a lesson as well.
My mother has a PhD. She went to Oxford on a full scholarship, and here she is working in the Alabama sun, picking crops because she has a dream.
By the time he was a teenager, Sean landed at a private school in Jacksonville, Florida, as a scholar and a swimmer. He fractured his spine. He made a comeback. He missed swimming for Nigeria in the Olympics by a tenth of a second. Sean wound up majoring in math and the classics as an undergrad and then enrolled in Yale Law School. By the time graduation came around, he knew he could rededicate himself to his Olympic dream. He figured the Winter Games might be his ticket, but which sport? He and his friends began watching some YouTube videos.
And we decided cross-country skiing was way too hard. We decided I'd probably kill myself in downhill skiing. I've never shot a gun. Biathlon was out.
Hockey, no. Luge, suicide.
And then we found skeleton, and everyone's like, what's this?
Skeleton became Sean's new passion. He took a job with Goldman Sachs in Salt Lake City, home to one of the country's two tracks dedicated to this head-first sliding sport that reaches 80 miles an hour. Sean began training 5 hours a day. It was daunting, but doable. Until
life comes and knocks along, and you just take another route.
Sean is standing in the kitchen of an apartment on Manhattan's east side. The location is significant because it's two blocks from Sloan Kettering Memorial, a hospital known for its cancer care.
Right now I've got 2 teaspoons of posaconazole. I've got some lansoprazole.
A few months ago, Sean found out that he had stem cell leukemia and lymphoblastic lymphoma, two particularly aggressive forms of cancer for which a bone marrow transplant was the best treatment. But Sean couldn't find a match. This isn't unusual for Africans or African Americans who are underrepresented in the registry and have a tissue type that's harder to match than Caucasians. Sean decided he needed to do something about this. He got in touch with Katarina Harf, the executive vice president of the Bone Marrow Donor Center, DKMS.
You know, the first time I met him, I just was like, oh my God, we have to work with this guy, and he's just so incredibly inspiring.
So with DKMS's help, he flew with his mom to Nigeria, where they established the country's first bone marrow registry. This Sunday, he's sponsoring a bone marrow drive at New York City's Yale Club, and he still trains, even through chemotherapy.
When I was staying in the hospital for 7 weeks, I would do lunges in the hallway and push my IV tube beside me. And the nurses would line up behind me and start doing lunges. So I had this little parade going on.
Sean smiles a lot more than you'd expect from a person who'll enter the hospital in 2 weeks to get a cord blood transplant, then spend about 6 weeks in isolation, and then the better part of a year without a functioning immune system. He says living with cancer is like living a highly concentrated, extremely potent version of life.
I feel very free. At the same time, I know that in a couple of weeks I'm going to lose a lot of freedom. I'm going to lose all control over my schedule. I'm going to lose control over what I eat, who I see. I'm going to lose my bone marrow. And then I'm going to literally be reborn.
Sean says there's a parallel between being a skeleton athlete and his overall life. There's a time for all-out effort, and then there's a time for surrender. Soon, this super-achieving young man will rely on his doctor's skill, his body's resilience, and just plain luck. He refers to this as the risky time. And then, he says, the dream begins anew. Mike Pesca, NPR News, New York.